University or college? Or
just Cooper Union.
Just Cooper Union.
The Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art.
Then he went on to get a degree in nuclear engineering, a PhD at the University of Michigan, and went immediately to Stanford University, where he's been for several decades. We won't say how many. And he's been in the mechanical engineering department, although in a division that's changed names, but I won't bother to give you all that detail. His main interest at the moment is computation and modeling of turbulent flows. Kinetic theory of gases was something in another life, previous life, I think, and also combustion. He has won a number of awards, most recently an Alex von Humboldt Fellowship and a Max Planck Research Prize. And some of you might know some of the books that he's written. A very old one that I'm familiar with on mathematical theory of transport processes and gases. Another one on numerical methods for engineering applications. And a recent one on computational methods for fluid dynamics. So we're delighted to have you here. And Bill Fritz is going to talk on numerical simulation of turbulence. There's a couple of seats down there.
Okay, I changed the title slightly, but same story, basically.
Let people get settled here. I think you got to go under the table. No, I can't take a seat with that. Okay. There's one here. Nice to see a full hall. What I'd really like to do is give a... I think probably there are a few people in the audience who know what turbulence is. Turbulence is like art, I think. Everybody knows it. Can't define it, but they know it when they see it, you know. So I think that's what it is to those of us who work in it. But, you know, the formal work in turbulence... something that I think not everybody here is familiar with, so I'll quickly go through some introduction to the simulation of turbulence, and then I'll give an example which actually comes from oceanography, which is some of our most recent work. Could give several other examples, but... Okay, first of all, what is turbulence? A lot of things that people would disagree about. There's a lot of things that we do agree on. I want to make sure I got this right. Somebody shined one in my eye once. It's very unsteady. It's noisy. It's three-dimensional. We all understand that it has strong vorticity in it. It also has a large range of length and time scales. This is really what makes it very difficult. It's highly nonlinear, I should have added. This makes it very, very difficult to describe. Very difficult to work with. However, we do know the exact equations, at least for simple fluids. Turbulence obeys the Navier-Stokes equations. So there's an exact set of equations that we know for the turbulence obeys. I think what really makes it difficult is this. We know that it's partly deterministic. There are something called coherent structures, and again, people are still arguing about what that really means, but everybody in the field sort of thinks they understand it, and I'm not sure that everybody else's picture is the same as mine, but we all agree that there are coherent structures in turbulence. These are usually some kind of vortices that tend to be repetitive time and time again. However, they're not identical, as one coherent structure is not exactly the same as another one in a turbulent flow, and they don't repeat at regular intervals. They have some jitter in when they reoccur. The problem with it is that a lot of us believe that the coherent structures in the flow, although they're only by energy about 10% of the flow, are probably responsible for something like 90% of the transport. By transport, I mean the transport of momentum, energy, species through the flow. So they're very important to the flow. Don't take these numbers very seriously, of course. This is somebody's guess, and it might be correct for one flow and wrong for another flow. They're also partly random. In turbulence, is largely random. 90% of the flow is probably noise, just jitter. I mean, if you look at turbulent signal, you'd probably say, oh, that's just noise. Well, what happens is that noise hides the coherent structures. And if you go to somebody in signal processing and tell them that you have a problem like this, they quickly throw you out of the room. I've done it. If you knew what the structures looked like, they could extract it. With a 10-to-1 noise to signal ratio, they could probably find it. But if you tell them that the structures are not identical or repeatable, and go find the structures, they get lost. And there's very little you can really do with this. So it's tough. Okay, so to sort of summarize that, the physics is very complex. It's nonlinear, three-dimensional, unsteady, etc. But we do know the exact equations. That means, with large computers nowadays, this is ideal for simulation. Since we know the equations, we could do simulations on the computer and perhaps learn something about the physics of turbulence. Okay, now of course we can also do experiments. And experiments are without doubt equally important, but they're very difficult to perform, and it's very difficult sometimes to control the variables in an experiment, in a physical experiment. So I like to do what I call numerical experiments, which I'll try to explain to you in some of the coming slides. We have a method called direct numerical simulation. What that means is we create a turbulent flow on the computer. We solve the Navier-Stokes equations. I say exact solution, but as exactly as you can with numerical methods on the computer. And you get a realization of a turbulent flow. So you set up some initial conditions that look something like turbulence. Let the Navier-Stokes equations develop these coherent structures that we know should be there, and they capture everything from the larger scale, which we call the integral scale, to the smaller scale, which is determined by the viscosity, which is called the Kolmogorov scale. So you get a complete realization of the flow in all its detail. Well, there's a fly in the ointment, of course, and that is, I told you, that the range of length scales between the largest and smallest scale is very large. In fact, it varies like the parameter known as the Reynolds number to the 3/4 power. This Reynolds number, by the way, in typical flows might vary from several hundred to 10 to the sixth, or a million. So this can be quite a large number. And therefore, the cost, because you have to do the flow, the calculation in three space dimensions and time simultaneously, the cost is going to scale something like the cube of the Reynolds number. Well, that immediately tells you that you're limited to very low Reynolds number flows, and for similar reasons, you're limited to simple geometries. I didn't give the argument here, but for the same reason, the more complicated the geometry, the more grid points you need, the more it's going to cost. So direct numerical simulation is wonderful. It has given us fantastic insight into the physics of turbulent flows, but it is very limited in what flows can be done, and how much information we can extract from them. Okay, so the limitations of the low Reynolds number and simple geometry, and that means for any realistic, for example, industrial flow or environmental flow, we haven't got a chance of doing a direct numerical simulation. That's exact simulation on the computer. Okay, so direct simulations are used to understand physics, but they can't be used to understand realistic flows. So what people typically do are what are called Reynolds average methods. This goes back to Osborne Reynolds in 1880 or so. What you do is take the Navier-Stokes equations and average them over an ensemble of identical flows, time or homogeneous direction, and what you do is get equations for this mean or average flow that you've gotten by this kind of averaging. In doing this, all of the unsteadiness is considered turbulence. And it produces an extra term, which is called the Reynolds stress. It's a tensor that has to be modeled in some way or another. There are various models. If any of you have ever had any contact with turbulence modeling, you've heard about some of these. What most people do is what's called an eddy viscosity model. A little bit more about that later. There are various subtypes of eddy viscosity models. I'm not going to get into the details of what they are here. Anybody wants to know, I'll be happy to talk a little bit about it privately. There are also multi-equation models. That is, you can write exact equations for the Reynolds stresses and model some of the terms in there. This was the great hope of the 70s and 80s, that this would be the way that we would be able to do complicated turbulent flows realistically. it's turned out to be an improvement over these models only in a limited number of flows, and it is not really a terribly good way to go. Finally, one of my colleagues is working on structure-based models, but I really don't want to say much about those. They're more complicated. That leads me to a compromise, which is called Large-Eddy simulation. The idea here is, the idea is that in turbulence, the largest scales are the ones that contain most of the energy, are associated with the coherent structures, and are probably the most important ones. The smaller scales are probably less important, easier to deal with, easier to model, and therefore, what we try to do is make a compromise where we actually simulate only the larger scales, like you do in direct numerical simulation, that is the simulations where you compute the entire flow, and you model the small scales as you do in the Reynolds average methods. So these are the two methods I've talked about before. The advantage, of course, is that by modeling the smaller scales, you can eliminate a lot of the range of length scales that we have to deal with, and therefore you need a lot less grid. You can either reduce the cost or you can do a more complicated flow. And we are doing some quite complicated flows now with large eddy simulation. I could show you some very, very complicated flows that we're currently working on. Okay, we define the large scales by filtering. Basically, it's a low-pass filter. You take the velocity field, and basically you do a local average. You can do a little kernel here, which is basically a localized function around X prime. And so what you get is a local average of the velocity, or, if you like, a low-pass filtered value of the velocity. So you've filtered out the small scales or the high frequencies, and you've left only the low frequencies or the smooth part of the variation. This definition allows comparison with the direct numerical simulation and experiments. And the other thing you need to watch out for is that the Nyquist criterion, numerical criterion, tells you that there's a size, of course, the size of the region over which you're averaging in this filtering operation. That size must be at least twice the grid size of the grid that you're using in the numerical calculation. By the way, a lot of people forget that. Okay. What happens then is you need a model for the small scales, which got called the subgrid scale model. It's not really a name that I like very much, but we're stuck with it. The nonlinearity in the Navier-Stokes equations produces this subfilter scale Reynolds stress, or subgrid scale Reynolds stress, this term, which has to be modeled. It can't be evaluated from the velocity that you're trying to compute, so you need to introduce a model for it. And the model has to depend on the local large-scale field or the past history of the local fluid. Okay. The models used, the simplest one, again, is an eddy viscosity model. This is the same as the one that's used in Reynolds averaging I talked about before. You assume that the unknown stress associated with the small scales is related to the strain rate tensor of the large fields. So you take the filtered velocity, compute its strain rate, and just assume proportionality between these stresses and the subgrid scales. The eddy viscosity can be derived in many ways. The standard formula that's almost everybody uses is this one, which is due to somebody named Smagorinsky, who very bravely used this kind of method to simulate the global weather in 1963. I mean, he was doing this with about 40 grid points in each direction around the world. Incredible. Okay. Well, this model, by the way, doesn't work all that well, so we need various improvements. One idea is to use the methods that our friends who've done Reynolds average models have used, and that is to introduce more equations. That technique has turned out not to work terribly well for the subgrid scale for various reasons. It's better. A better technique, one that's turned out to be very valuable, is because we're doing a simulation of the large scales, what we can argue is that the smallest scales that we're retaining, the smallest scales of the field that we are resolving, look something like the still smaller scales that we're not resolving, and therefore we can learn something about how to model the very smallest scales by looking at the smallest scales that are actually captured. And that's the technique that actually does work, or has proven most successful. So just some of the ideas that are used for model improvement. First of all, there's something we call the scale similarity model. What you assume is that the smallest of the large scales, the ones that you are capturing and you are computing in the simulation, look a lot like the scales that are being modeled, the ones that just miss getting through the filter. Okay? So that leads you to a model that looks like this, which can be calculated if you have the mean velocity field, UI bar. You calculate this by filtering again, and you then have a model for the subgrid scale. Turns out that this isn't sufficiently dissipative, so we can't use that as a model by itself, and therefore we can construct a mixed model, which is a combination of this and Smagorinsky, and that model works quite well. Well, at least it's an improvement on Smagorinsky. Okay. We can test models. One nice way to do a test model is to use direct numerical simulation. The direct numerical simulation provides everything you want to know about the velocity field on perhaps maybe a couple of million grid points. What we can do is take that direct numerical simulation and filter it and ask, what is the velocity field that large eddy simulation should compute? And what is it that would have to be modeled if we were doing a large eddy simulation? So we can, at the same time, get the exact subgrid scale Reynolds stress, the term that has to be modeled, and the model estimation of it. We can compare those point by point by using correlation coefficients or scatter plots, and we can also get the model parameter that way. So that's basically what we call a priori testing based on direct numerical simulation. Okay. The model that has seen the most, gotten the most press, at least, during the 1990s, at least, is the so-called dynamic model. It's really a procedure. What we do is, I'm going to give just a quickie introduction to it. What we're doing is a priori testing kind of on the fly. So as we're doing the large eddy simulation, we say, hey, this isn't really a large eddy simulation. It's a direct numerical simulation. Then what we can do is filter that velocity field and do an a priori kind of test on it with a broader filter. We can then calculate the parameter, and then we assume that the same model with the same parameter applies on both levels, both the actual large eddy simulation level and this broader filter level, with only a different length scale, but the same parameter. So therefore, the parameter needed in the model is actually computed from the simulation itself. So you do the simulation, you then go through this procedure point by point, you predict the local value of the coefficient, having the of the parameter that you need in the model, and you use that in the model. And that's the dynamic procedure. Well, I won't give the details of this. Anybody wants the details, please write to me or something, and I'll be happy to give you references on all of this material or review articles. If you do the dynamic procedure, as I just described, the parameter varies rapidly in space and time both. And worse yet, by the way, the fluctuations are typically about 10 times the average value, the mean value. So they're very large positive and negative values in the eddy viscosity coefficient. The average value is quite reasonable. The result is when you have large negative viscosities, anybody who's done any numerical simulation will know that that will make your simulation unstable. You do a calculation with negative viscosity, or equivalently backward in time, you're going to get real trouble in numerical stability. So the calculation's going to blow up, and that typically is what's going to happen. So what we have to do is reduce the variation of the parameter that we get. And one way to do that is by averaging over space or time. Another way is to cut off the negative values of it. There are several improved values of it, which I just give you the names here without describing them in any detail. But there are some decent models of this dynamic type now. Rather than dynamic, I really prefer to call it self-consistent. The coefficient is actually derived from the calculation itself in the process of by the process that I've just described. So there's no external input needed as far as parameters into the calculation. You just simply do the large eddy simulation, determine the parameter self-consistently from the simulation itself, and go on your merry way. Okay. The latest thing are what's called the convolution models. And this has gotten a lot of press since about the 1998. Again, just review the definitions of the subgrid scale Reynolds stress and the large scale field. What we're going to do is try and extract the exact velocity field from this filtered velocity field, and then use that to compute tau ij. That's the idea. I'm going to give only one simple version of this. The simplest version is to just use a Taylor series. The easiest thing. Just use a Taylor series. Substitute this into the definition of ui bar. And what you do is get this. Do an approximate inversion of this. In other words, first assume that ui is equal to ui bar. Then take that and put it in over here. And you get an approximate expression for ui. Substitute that into the definition of tau ij. And you have the model. Again, no parameters in the model. It works quite well for quite a range of flows. A few words on numerical accuracy. A lot of people do these calculations. A lot of people have gotten into large eddy simulation. They just simply take the code that they have for steady flows and try to apply it to large eddy simulation, which is time-dependent. The first thing is that for spatial discretization, you need high accuracy over a wide range of length scales. A consequence of that is the order. See, people talk about a first order, second order, fourth order method, and so on. Order is actually not a very good figure of merit for doing calculations in which there are a large range of length scales. As a result, spectral and compact methods are often used. Whenever you can use them, these are very good choices because they give you more accuracy for a given amount of given number of grid points, and that's very important. Same thing on time advance. The accuracy usually sets the time step. Most people in doing steady calculations are used to setting the time step in order to get the solution steady state solution as quickly as possible. Here, the accuracy in time is required, and the time step has to be set to achieve that accuracy. In fact, what you should do is balance the spatial and temporal errors in the calculation as well as you can, as nearly as you can. You can't do that exactly, but you want to try and balance those errors as nearly as you can. If you don't balance them, that means you're spending more for either the spatial part of the calculation or the temporal part of the calculation, and that's just waste. Okay? By the way, the time step that you'll get here is usually small enough that the explicit methods can be used, and some terms can be treated implicitly. Okay, so just to conclude this sort of introductory part, direct numerical simulation, that is just solving the Navier-Stokes equations, is very good for investigating the physics of turbulent flows. Large eddy simulation is applicable more widely. We can do complex flows. We are doing things now like turbine blade passages, gas turbine combustors. What else? People have done a number of other engineering devices. We've done cyclone separators. The dynamic model is a major advance, but it's still it's far from perfect. Large eddy simulation, well, people usually use Reynolds. In industry, people tend to use these Reynolds average models as much as they can. So if you go to almost any company that has to predict turbulent flows, most of them are using Reynolds average models. However, these don't always give good results. And therefore, when it doesn't give results, people are turning now more and more to large eddy simulation. And it can also be used to perform unique experiments. In fact, experiments that actually violate some of the laws of physics. So we've done that. Okay, this concludes a little introduction. It would be a good time to stop for some questions if anybody wants to ask some. I'm now going to go on to a particular application here, which, by the way, again, comes from oceanography. Any oceanographers here? I know there's a good oceanography group here at UBC. Uh-huh. Yes?
You mentioned about the large eddy simulation. Now, with the speed of computer that we are going to see for future, how long do you think it takes that direct numerical simulation can be applied for any kind of random number and general geometry that daily use the SNL average for large eddy simulation?
Okay. It's a good question, but a hard one to answer because it's really application dependent. Okay, it depends on the particular flow that you're looking at. There are some flows for which large eddy simulation can, and I know of some industrial applications that were done a few years ago where people actually did large eddy simulation and solved some questions that they had in industrial flows. Like they had flow-induced vibrations, they did not understand the origin of them. They did a large eddy simulation, got a good guess as to what was causing the problem, thought of a way to fix it, tried the fix on the computer, then which showed that it works, tried the fix then in the laboratory, it worked, it was built into their device. So there are applications today. I think as computers get bigger and bigger, large eddy simulation will do more and more of the job. It's never going to take over the entire field by a long shot. More and more things will be done with large eddy simulation. There are some things that can be done very, very well with Reynolds average calculations. Those cost one or two orders of magnitude less. You should do them that way. There are some flows which I can list that don't, for which large eddy for which Reynolds average models don't work. We hope large eddy simulation will work. It's, by the way, not guaranteed by a long shot. So, but we hope that large eddy simulation will work for those. So I think large eddy simulation will see more and more use, but it's not a good idea to assume that it's automatically going to work for any flow that you choose to compute. That's not guaranteed. Okay? Is that? Yes?
You said you wouldn't talk about this, but who is doing structure-based models for Reynolds crystals?
My colleague Reynolds. This is Bill Reynolds, not Osborne. Okay. At Stanford, we call the Reynolds number the Osborne number. Okay? That's Bill Reynolds. He's been working, let me tell you, he's been working on it about 10 years. About every year I hear him give a seminar on this thing. Every year it's different, and I'm not sure I completely understand it. I could explain the basis of it to you, but I couldn't really explain exactly how the model works to you. They have done some calculations that look very, very exciting, as a matter of fact. Yes, it is promising, but whether it's the wave of the future, I have no idea. Nobody else has picked it up yet. I haven't seen anybody do anything on it other than Reynolds and his students themselves. So it's, despite 10 years of work on it, it's a little early to tell. I think it's an interesting idea. The idea, by the way, is that in addition to doing the moments of the velocity, components of the velocity, ui, uj, you also keep information about the spatial distribution of the turbulence, spatial correlation. That's what the structure is. So you've got the two-point correlation function that plays a role in this model. That's what it's based on. I don't want to get into anything further on it. Okay, you had a question?
Yeah, I don't want to distract us too much, but in the atmosphere, which is where I work, one of the outstanding problems is entrainment on the top of the bond.
Yes.
And the LES stuff doesn't make any sense yet. Certainly the ensemble average stuff goes nowhere.
Yes.
Do any of the DNS methods that you use in engineering, do you think they could be applicable?
I actually did.
You wrote the question, are there engineering applications of entrainment that have worked with DNS?
Yes, for sure. Okay. I mean, for example, you have entrainment at the edge of a boundary layer, and we have done very good simulations of a growing engineering boundary layer.
Right.
We have that. By the way, I did some simulations of the atmospheric boundary layer, including entrainment at the top. We did this in DNS, okay, which usually you meteorologists jump all over me about. We simulated an atmosphere about that thick.
Right.
But we were able to show that we could predict some of the properties of the real atmosphere quite accurately, despite having the parameters obviously far off, okay? And we did have some results on entrainment. It was a thesis many years ago. What happened was the student left the field, and the stuff never got published, unfortunately. So yes, work has been done about this. Whether I'm willing to tell you that this is the end of the story, I don't think so, okay? We haven't solved the problem, but yes, it's possible. I think the real problem with most of these things is that if you really want to study entrainment at the top of the boundary layer, you have to use a much finer grid up there. And I don't think anybody's really done that.
Well, my student who wanted in late past the light, she tried that and showed that it was not a grid problem. It was the way we resolved the physics. It was not in... This is in ensemble average mode, though.
Okay, okay. Okay.
It was clear that the fault was in the physics, not in the...
No, I think if you did a large eddy simulation with a refined grid up there...
Right.
And that's not easy, by the way. There's some problems you have to resolve before you can do that.
Yeah.
I think you have a chance of doing it right.
Yeah.
Okay? I'd really be stupid to make guarantees about this, but yeah. Other questions? Okay, then you probably will know this problem that's coming up next. Oops, I got the back end of it here. This is from a student. Langmuir cells. Now, first of all, I'll tell you what they are, and then describe what we're doing. First of all, what are they? Anybody here know what Langmuir cells are? Yeah, I'm sure you would. I think I saw an oceanographer back there somewhere. He would know what they are. Here's a picture taken by actually somebody. Andrew Seri is a professor at University of California, Berkeley. This picture was taken in Rodeo Lagoon, which is a very tiny bay just north of San Francisco. I can tell you by looking at this picture that it's not very deep, and it's probably got a fairly flat bottom. Okay? What you will notice in this picture is the feature that you really want to look at is you've got these long straight lines of basically foam that's on top of the surface. The question is, why is the foam all in these nice straight lines? These were first seen, by the way, by a man named Irving Langmuir, the guy who's well known in plasma physics. Apparently he was taking a ferry one day and he saw things like this and said, what's going on here? Well, what he decided is the way that this happens is there must be vortices underneath the surface. They're rotating like this. And then the surface current is going to push things together before it descends. And if there's anything floating on the surface, it's all going to collect where these vortices meet. We're just above the descending part of the vortex. So he decided there must be a vortex pair between each of these lines. There are more interesting things about that, but I don't really have time to get into it. But the most important thing is you get these features, which are relatively long and very straight, which exist. It's also been noticed, and it's been known for quite a while now, that these features exist when the wind continually blows in one direction for a certain length of time. And that's clearly what's going on here. Oh, the other thing I do want you to notice is that if you look at the wave crests in here, you'll see that they're perpendicular to these Langmuir cells. Okay, so the waves are in there. The wind has to be blowing this way at this point, and it's creating some surface waves. Its wind is probably not all that strong because the waves aren't that high. And the water is probably just a couple of meters deep in this particular lagoon. And you get these long, thin Langmuir cells. Question, where do they come from? Well, first of all, a little bit about the physics of ocean waves. Everybody's seen ocean waves. I mean, if you ask a student typically in engineering to tell you about a wave, he'll tell you about an ocean wave. And that is the worst possible example. Vibrating string is much better. The velocity does go like is sinusoidal in x and exponential in z. And I forget to put in here also sinusoidal in time, of course. The vertical component of the velocity is the same thing but out of phase with the streamwise velocity. The particle paths are not closed. This is one of the interesting things in this flow, that if you actually watch the particle move with the wave velocity, what would happen is because the forward velocity is very high near the top, when it gets down to the bottom, the backward velocity at depth decreases exponentially, so it's not as large, and therefore the particle follows this kind of a cycloid with a drift to in one direction. So there's a Stokes drift, which is proportional to the wave height squared. And again, that was known already by Stokes back in 1850 or whenever it was. The surface wind stress also causes a current. Obviously, if the wind blows over a surface, even without the presence of waves, that's going to push a current in the water below the surface. There is also an unsteady viscous boundary layer due to the wave at the top. That is a second source of another current that can be quite important. That was discovered by Longett Higgins in the 1950s. So it's really, there's a lot going on there, even without this stuff. The Langmuir cells, we're now quite sure of this, are caused by a combination of the Stokes drift and the current. There's a spanwise perturbation of the vorticity that creates streamwise vortices, which are the Langmuir cells. Okay, I'm going to go through this quickly. Okay, what we know about Langmuir cells and Langmuir circulations is that they enhance the mixing of heat, mass, and momentum. They contribute to horizontal dispersion. By the way, the ocean, again, the important thing to understand about the ocean is most of it, despite the huge Reynolds numbers, most of it is essentially laminar. There's a region up at the top, which is 1 to 200 meters thick, called the mixed layer, which is turbulent and well-mixed and fairly uniform in temperature. Immediately below that is what's called the thermocline. The thermocline, there's a drop of in temperature which might be 3 to 5 degrees C over a region of about 10 meters thick. That's very heavily stratified, and the region below that is also somewhat stratified and therefore not turbulent. Okay, so Langmuir circulations are very important in modeling the ocean. We think that they're responsible for quite a bit of the mixing between the surface water and the water that lies below it. Okay. Now, there is a theory for them, which is done by Craik and Leibovitz in the 1970s. Again, the key assumptions are that there's current and Stokes drift. They assume that the time scale of the turbulence is shorter than the time scale of the wave, and it's shorter than the time scale for development of the Langmuir cells. What they then do is take the Navier-Stokes equations and basically do a multiple time scale analysis. This is a math institute, so I think some of you must know how this technique goes. You basically average over the short time scale and get an equation which is valid on the longer time scale. What you get is basically the Navier-Stokes equations again with an extra term. That's the Stokes drift. And this is the vorticity due to the current. And this term is what's responsible for the development of Langmuir cells. There are two mechanisms that they describe, but I don't think it's necessary to go into the details of them. Okay, there have been previous numerical simulations. I won't put up the list. There are quite a few of these. So what we want to do is develop a three-dimensional model for studying this, the wave-current interaction. We want to see what Langmuir cells are really all about, and we want to evaluate their effects on mixing. And finally, we want to determine the limits of the validity of the Craik-Leibovitz theory. Okay, so what we're going to do is we had a flow for a channel for doing a channel flow with a moving wave with a open free surface. What we're going to do is add a moving wavy surface to the top. So we're going to give a stress on the top that represents the effect of the wind. We're going to include a no-slip bottom, so we really have a solid bottom on this thing. This is not very physically correct. It would be better to have this thermocline that I was talking about before, but this turned out to be a very fortunate choice for a reason that I'll show you later, that we actually have a solid bottom down there. Okay. We specify the top upper surface to be a Stokes wave. That is a wave according to Stokes' theory of water waves, correct to second order. And this is specified. So we have the wave field is built into the calculation. My student Zoe developed an orthogonal transformation from. Well, then what we do is the wave, of course, is progressing. We move into a coordinate system which is moving at the phase speed of the wave. So the wave is stationary in the system that we're calculating at, which means that the bottom is basically moving in the reverse direction at the wave speed. She developed an orthogonal transformation for going from this wavy coordinate system to a rectangular coordinate system. We're going to solve the Navier-Stokes equations in this transformed coordinate system using all the correct boundary conditions at the top. There are several parameters, the wave height, the wave number or wavelength, the spanwise wavelength, the Reynolds number based on the friction provided at the top, and another Reynolds number based on the Stokes drift. And there's something called the Langmuir number, which is a combination of those. Okay. We first did a calculation of a two-dimensional channel flow. Here's a comparison of our large eddy simulation with direct numerical simulation. We're a little bit off, but that's what normally happens with large eddy simulation. It isn't exact. and it produces a difference, which I can explain, but it would take a little bit of, take a little while. For the Reynolds stress, there's the correlation between the fluctuating velocities. It produces quite nice results. So we were confident that the code is okay. We then did a calculation with the Craig-Leibovich method. And there is, this is a line with the slope provided by the Craig-Leibovich theory, the growth rate of the Langmuir cells, and this is the numerical result. They agree to, these two slopes agree to two significant figures. We then also computed the error in this slope versus the number of grid points, and we do get a line of slope minus 2, indicating that the method is second order accurate as it should be. So we've tested that, that this method is numerically accurate. Okay. So we then did the calculation. Okay, now as I said, there are two sources of current in the flow. Here's the horizontal drift velocity. This is the Stokes drift, which decreases exponentially. The other one, which decreases linearly, is the one due to the wavy boundary layer at the top. The fact that there is a viscous boundary layer at the top under this oscillating wave. It's important to have both of those, and we're going to include both of them in the calculation. Well, we did the calculation. This is a laminar flow now, by the way. And there, I don't know why she didn't center these. There, indeed, are in the cross-flow plane are the vectors, and you can see that there are indeed, there is indeed a vortex under the surface. So that foam that you saw back in the photograph would be right there at that point. It would all collect there. So if any, if there was anything on the surface, it would be pushed over. If it was over here, it would be pushed to the left. If it's over there, it would be pushed to the right, and would just sit right there. That explains why, this is Langmuir's concept of why you have these flow, these what causes those windrows that we were seeing. The waves are propagating in the direction out of the plane of the board, by the way. You'll also know that the Langmuir, notice that the Langmuir cells fill the entire volume of the flow. This is the solid bottom that I was talking about earlier. The Langmuir cells fill the entire volume of the flow.
Is the asymmetry due to the difference between friction at top and bottom, or absence of friction?
No, it's just due to the nature of the vortices themselves. Basically, the boundary conditions imply that you have image vortices, and those image vortices push the vortices in a particular way, which is one way of explaining it, which basically is squeezes them together this way. So what happens is that in the laminar case, it, by the way, that's a good point that you make. In the laminar case, the descending part of the flow is narrower than the ascending part. Okay? And that's just due to the interaction of the vortices. Here's the span-wise average downwind velocity. Here's what it was initially, I showed earlier. Here's what happens with Langmuir cells, and it just mixes everything out. These things are very efficient. Even though the velocities associated with the Langmuir cells are only a few percent of the mean velocity of the flow, it doesn't take them very long to just mix everything. They provide, because they're the only thing that provides enough vertical velocity to get some mixing, and they just mix the velocity and basically create a uniform profile with a small boundary layer at the top and the bottom. Here's the development in time. We started with just random boundary conditions. This thing then went to creating four cells, or actually I think it's something like six cells. Then it created two, and then they finally reached their equilibrium state, and that's where the flow sits. This is a laminar case, so it just stays there. Let's go through that. Okay, then we did a calculation. Again, I don't know why the two are reversed here, but this is a flow done according to the two-dimensional Craig-Leibovich theory. This is the flow done with an actual three-dimensional wavy coordinate system that I described before. The two are identical. By the way, notice the scales are the same. So these two flows are really identical. The Craig-Leibovich theory really does work for this flow. We then compared the average velocity in the two cases. They're almost identical. The total kinetic energy of the turbulence after the flow develops. Again, same in the two cases. So the Craig-Leibovitz theory really does work in the laminar case. Okay, now we go to the turbulent case. First of all, things get complicated now. We're going to take the flow and divide it into four separate parts. First of all, there's the mean current. That's the current that I described before. So there's just a mean current that you get by averaging the flow basically over planes. But this is a little bit tricky because you have a wavy top coordinate system. We averaged over the planes that correspond to surfaces of constant coordinate in this orthogonal transformation that I talked about before. Okay? If you do a horizontal average, as I just said, you get the mean current. If you do a spanwise average, you get the mean current plus the waves. So if you average over the spanwise, you remove the effect of the Langmuir cells, and all that remains is the mean current and the waves. If you average in the streamwise direction, that is, in the way the direction that the wind is blowing, you get the Langmuir cells and the mean current again. Okay? And then if you ensemble average, or time average, you get all three of these, the mean current, the waves, and the Langmuir cells. What we then did is we said that anything in the total field that didn't belong to one of these three components is turbulence. That's his F double prime. So there are four components: mean current, waves, Langmuir cells, turbulence. Okay? And in some of the special cases, there are fewer components. Okay, now, here's where we get. We did the calculation. This is after it's fully developed, by the way. The wind is blowing that way. What we're showing is the vorticity in four separate planes. We took a look at this picture, and we got worried. Where are the Langmuir cells? Well, they're there, but you just can't see them in this picture. The reason is that the fluctuations are actually several times bigger than the mean Langmuir cells themselves. So what we then did is took these results, and averaged them over time. So we averaged this over time, and what you now find is this. There they are. There's the Langmuir cells again. The fact that they're a little fuzzy means that we probably have an average long enough in time. You'll also, if you compare them, you'll find that they're somewhat weaker than they were before in the laminar case. But there are Langmuir cells in there in the time mean flow. So, yes, indeed, they exist. And, in fact, the velocity vectors are very much like we showed before. Here they are. This is a flow done with the Craig-Leibovitz theory. This is a flow done with the 3D wave, the full Navier-Stokes equations. What you'll notice here is that the Langmuir cells are actually stronger in this case than they are in that case. You can notice that by larger, darker regions in that flow. More about that a little bit later. So the Craig-Leibovitz theory isn't quite correct in this case. In fact, if you take the streamwise average velocity of the spanwise velocity, of the spanwise velocity, this is what the Craig-Leibovitz theory predicts. This is what the full Navier-Stokes equations give. And what you see is that, in fact, the velocity is reduced by about a third, it turns out, relative to the Craig-Leibovitz theory. The reason for this is fairly easy to find out. I mean, the difference between the theory, we're going to see this consistently in everything we do here. The difference between the theory and the full Navier-Stokes equations is very simple. The theory assumed that all of the turbulence has timescales shorter than the wave period. That's not true. There is turbulence of longer periods. And that difference, I think, is what's responsible for the differences that we're going to see here. The same is true, by the way, for the vertical component of the velocity. You notice that it's reduced by about a third. So the Langmuir cells, basically, are weaker by about 30% in the full Navier-Stokes equations relative to the Craig-Leibovitz theory. Again, the reason for this, I think, is that the Navier-Stokes equations give us more, quote, turbulence. The turbulence does more mixing. You get weaker Langmuir cells as a result. There's still more things to sort out here, but that's... That's what we've got right now. The mean current? Not too, a little bit different than in the two cases, but a lot different from what you get in just a channel flow. The Langmuir cells really mix that velocity field out. If you had just a channel flow, you'd have this profile, that one, with Langmuir cells present. Everything gets mixed except for the little boundary layer at the top and at the top and the bottom. And this is just the same velocity field plotted in a different way. Let's leave that one out of here. The structure of the flow is also quite different. This is without waves on the surface at all. It's just a simple pressure-driven flow with the flow going that way. What you notice is a lot of structure on the flow on the surface, but it seems to be relatively isotropic. These represent velocity, positive and negative fluctuations of the velocity. What you'll notice is that they're about equal, and they're about isotropic. These structures are a little bit elongated in the streamwise direction, but otherwise they seem to be pretty much isotropic. When you put waves on, things really change. This is due to the wave-induced current at the surface. You suddenly get very elongated structures. They're much narrower. They've been stretched out in the streamwise direction. This is the effect of the current produced directly by the wave. Okay. Let's leave that one out. Here's the turbulence intensities. This is in the channel flow. This is what you get with the Craig-Leibovitz theory. This is what we get from the full Navier-Stokes equations. Again, the Navier-Stokes equations give more turbulence, and because they give more turbulence, they give weaker Langmuir cells. So that's that combination. The two fit exactly together, as you might expect. The horizontal average velocity, again, there's a difference. This is the horizontal average root mean square fluctuations of the span-wise velocity. Again, you get more turbulence in the 3D from the Navier-Stokes equations than you'd get from the Craig-Leibovitz theory. So Craig-Leibovitz theory isn't bad, but it's missing something, and I think we have some ideas how to correct it, but we haven't tried them out yet. Same thing here. Turbulence intensities, you get more from the Navier-Stokes equations than you get from the Craig-Leibovitz theory. Okay. My favorite little piece is this, and why are Langmuir cells important? Here's what's called the Reynolds stress. This is basically the vertical transport of momentum created by the turbulence or by the flow itself. This has to be approximately constant. Okay, this is just the part due to the turbulence. This has to be approximately constant, except in the boundary layers where there's some viscous effects. So in the channel flow, you get a flat profile near the center and then decreases near the surface. And the difference between the flat line here and the actual curve is the viscous part of the stress. When we do the Langmuir cell calculations, what we find, again, is get a significant difference. You get a very large Reynolds stress at the top, but very little further down. This, by the way, should be impossible. The total Reynolds stress has to be constant across here. You're basically putting momentum at the top and taking it out at the bottom, and the momentum flux has to be constant in between. So something is missing here. The question is, what is missing? We want to look at that. Again, the full Navier-Stokes equation is giving more than the Craig-Leibovitz theory. Okay, here's the rest of the story. We computed now the Reynolds stress as the momentum transport. Due to all these, I told you we divided the flow into four different components. You take the product of the two velocities, average them, and you get 16 components. Actually, it's less than that because of some symmetries. But you have a lot of components. Only two of them are really significant. First of all, there's the one we saw on the preceding slide. That's the part that's created by the turbulence, the fluctuating velocities themselves. Here's the effect of the Langmuir cells. So even though the Langmuir cells are small, what we're finding is that the Langmuir cells, they are responsible for the mixing which occurs deep down, and therefore extremely important. I mean, if you want mixing in the ocean, this turbulence, the red line, doesn't produce much turbulence down here where the thermocline would be, and is not capable of producing much entrainment down at the thermocline. Langmuir cells, on the other hand, are not very important at the surface where the turbulence keeps them under control, but once the turbulence disappears, the Langmuir cells take over, and they are responsible for the mixing that occurs down at the bottom of the mixed layer. They are what can create deepening of the mixed layer or entrainment at the thermocline. Okay, and that's basically the story in the two cases. There are, again, differences in the details in the two cases, but they agree. And then also, if you look at the total stress, you find that it looks exactly as it should be. It's flat in the center, and then there's two boundary layers at the top and bottom in both cases. So, let's finish off. Okay, Langmuir cells have been successfully simulated in a wavy domain in 3D for the first time. By the way, let me say, this calculation was done on a Cray T3E, I think. It took a month and a half. We only did one simulation for that reason. This is expensive stuff. We now have a parallel version of the code, and we should be able to get some simulations done a little bit faster than that on newer computers. The predicted Langmuir circulations agree with observations. Well, I haven't really shown that, but that's true in the parameters that we can look at. There are multiple scales. The logarithmic profile near the wall, which I didn't discuss, is essentially destroyed. The Langmuir circulations, the Langmuir cells, contribute significantly to the mixing. Okay? The other thing is that, as we noticed, the fluctuations are as big as the Langmuir cells, as strong as the Langmuir cells themselves. So there aren't any, the nice picture Langmuir cells that we showed there exist only in a long-term mean. So they are there, but and that gives rise to some very interesting physical effects that I didn't want to get into here. The Eulerian mean flow needs to be included in the theory, that boundary layer that comes, that little flow that's due to the viscous boundary layer at the top surface. And the Craik-Labovitz theory works very well in the laminar cases, but underpredicts the turbulent intensity and overpredicts the Langmuir cells in the turbulent case. Okay, so basically I hope I've shown that we can use Blagetti simulation to, by the way, this is what was done with the dynamic model. We can use Blagetti simulation to really learn about something that happens in a real system. Future work, we should include the Coriolis force, Earth's rotation. We should incorporate some surface heating due to the solar effects and radiation. The effects of stratification should be included. Surface wave breaking is going to be very difficult, but it would be nice to include it. And, well, we've already done this. We have improved the code efficiency with parallelization. And as I said, the wave shape has been specified in this calculation. We should really do it with a real free surface. That's going to cost, if that's cost a month and a half, we're now looking at 3 or 4 months. So we're not about to do that one very soon. Okay, that's what I have to say. Hope I've convinced you that Blagetti simulation is a good way to do at least some turbulent flows.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.